I kind of feel like I come from the tech world, but just want to make an impact in healthcare.
Sean Duffy, CEO of Amada Health, was the kind of guy who took a second chemistry class instead of doing PE. He had a near miss with medical school and was lured away by the siren song of Google, finding himself in the thick of Silicon Valley.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm David Shaywitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan.
So, I hear you're going on a little journey to the big city.
Yep. Kind of nervous.
I've been in New York thousands of times.
Really? Mm-hmm. What's it like?
Well, there are some things you should know. First off, you see gum on the street, leave it there. It's not free candy.
Oh.
Second, there are like 30 Ray's pizzas. They all claim to be the original, but the real one's on 11.
Sean, so I know you made your own personal journey to the big city back in the day on your way from Harvard to Google, and had a lot of appreciation for humor and how important that is in the workplace. So I have to believe along the way you've had a mentor or two that was able to guide you through with good humor on your way to putting Amada together.
You know, it's funny. Ahead of going to New York, in some ways, I felt like Will Ferrell in Elf. And then I grew up in Colorado Springs, which is, it's a sizable city, but not the largest. And I had all of these amazing misconceptions about what New York would be like that were immediately dissolved once I landed there.
And did you find the original Ray's Pizza?
Yeah, I did immediately. It was amazing how quickly that one popped up.
So who was the mentor for you? Who was your Santa Claus? Who told you how to navigate from where you started out to now where you ended up at Amada? Who was your most important mentor?
Well, so there's been a couple along the way. You know, I think the most important was maybe a little bit more recent at IDEO, a gentleman named David Webster, who, you know, at the time was globally responsible for their healthcare work at IDEO. You know, since then has gone off to run the Palo Alto office. And, you know, David is just an incredibly insightful, creative person. And what I loved most about him and what, you know, I've drawn on really from him as a mentoring leader is he's had this incredible authenticity in life and wasn't afraid to really just get excited about the way the world could be, which you have to always make sure to protect and retain as an entrepreneur. You really have to, you know, let yourself feel how amazing, you know, the world could be. And that pulls you toward making that a reality.
How did you wind up at IDEO?
Yeah, that was an interesting story. So I have always been passionate jointly about tech and healthcare. While actually working in technology, I was at Google at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading a medical blog called MedGadget, you know, one of my favorite blogs on the internet. And, you know, I would always kind of like to write. And I ended up writing for MedGadget. And they would send me to these conferences. And I covered TEDMed. You know, back when it was reignited in San Diego for MedGadget, and ended up kind of standing next to a gentleman named Dennis Boyle from IDEO in the shrimp cocktail line at that conference. And while in med school, the MD-MBA program I was part of required me to take an internship that's a mix of business and medicine. So I just reached back out to this guy and was like, hey, do you think IDEO would benefit from a medical student just hanging out? And then I promised them I'd be incredibly inexpensive. you know, and they took the bait.
That's great. So what was his greatest piece of advice to you? Do you remember? Does he have a mantra for you?
It wasn't, you know, it's funny. It wasn't the mantra that really, really helped. It was almost like just observing him in action. Where you pick up on how he handled certain situations and got the team excited. And it's never kind of this grandiose, like, one-liners. It's the in-the-trenches, you know, scenario-specific kind of guidance that helps you build the requisite pattern recognition to, you know, ideally, you know, work similarly well.
One of the things about IDEO that I always thought was so interesting, there's a wonderful book written, I think it's called Creative Confidence, written by the two founders, right, of IDEO. And there's this great story they tell in it, right, where they have two sort of a pottery class that's divided into two groups. And the goal is to have, you know, the best potter at the end of the semester. And one group is told, your goal is to have the very best pottery at the end of the semester. And they work really hard and they craft each individual piece with incredible retention. The other group is told they're going to be evaluated by the volume of a pottery that's produced. And then at the end, and they just wind up throwing up pot after pot after pot after pot. And at the end of the day, they say, it was actually the team that just sort of didn't overanalyze it and just practiced and practiced and it got all the experience that actually had not just more pots, but wind up producing better pots. So the idea is that not just to overthink, but to sort of get involved. And was that, that story has always stuck with me from the book. And I was wondering, is that something that you incorporated or that you felt while you were there?
Oh, for sure. No, I mean, you totally feel that. And there's a lot of, you know, obviously that's an anecdote, but I think there's a lot of behavioral science around that. And that, actually the hardest part of any task is actually initialization and starting it. And there can be so much like fear on the other side of it, thinking, oh my gosh, before I even start that, I need to be perfect. Like, what if it's not? Where if you get comfortable with just like giving it a go in certain scenarios, you kind of iterate your way to perfection really fast. And I think, you know, humans are predisposed to not quite overcoming the activation energy.
It's hard
when the expectation is perfection.
Well, you
see it a lot, and that's ingrained.
I know you told me that when you left Google to go to IDEO, you had in your mind that you were going to start the Starbucks for primary care. So whatever happened with that? Did you not initialize?
Well, I may go off and do it with Omada.
Well played.
That's the Starbucks for pre-diabetes, whatever, right? Intervention.
Yeah, yeah.
So how did that idealization? You know, it's interesting, David, listening to you talk about that. I thought you were going to go to a totally different place.
I'm going left, and then I faint right. So.
I thought you were going to go to that volume versus value conversation. But Sean, you know, what about for your experience in Omada and putting that company together? How did that initialization issue play itself out?
The original like instinct wanting to build Starbucks for primary care settled on a couple kind of fundamentals that I believe are incredibly important to our business. One, software is best to re-engineer processes, and re-engineering processes is most applied for care that's either at the primary care level or care that's in between visits. So, you know, I believe pretty strongly that you can make the best orthopedic search in, you know, maybe 5-10% better with software, but you can do a 10x on things that are in the primary care setting or things that involve any interaction through technology for patients between the visits. So that, honestly, that was my instinct going in. And, you know, a lot of that instinct is really held with Omada, which is thinking about ways that software can just lower these friction points to, you know, the activation energy for getting people exactly what they need at that point in time and, you know, making care more efficient and more scalable.
So maybe we can explain what the idea of the DC of Omada is. And I know I'm so, you know, as a, you know, trained as an endocrinologist, I'm so excited by what Omada is trying to do. But if everyone isn't familiar with it, do you want to just sort of go over what the premise is and then how you've executed on it?
Yeah, sure. So, for those not in the diabetes space, the core concept is, we're barreling toward a crisis of just epic magnitude as it relates to obesity-related chronic disease, specifically diabetes. David, I don't know if you saw the latest CDC stats, but they're estimating that 40% of adults at some point in their life will find out that they have type 2 on given trajectory.
Right.
So really, really just a horrific trend, unfortunately. And, in large part, just relates to the food culture and corresponding obesity crisis that we face as a country. The slight silver lining in all of this is that it's entirely preventable, but it requires really heavy artillery. And there was this famous trial called the Diabetes Prevention Program, where they took folks at high risk for type 2 or with prediabetes. They dropped in the paratroopers to help them in every way conceivable. They lost, a meaningful amount of weight, and that ended up reducing their risk of getting the disease quite substantially. And there's this clinical landscape evolving, in various pockets of the country that is working hard to make it standard of care so that folks with prediabetes are referred to or recommended enter an intensive program that's based on this original trial. And Omada has built the first digital instantiation of some new standards that the CDC has put forth for how to do this right. We've been going at it ever since. You can think of it as kind of the second step to someone finding out they're at risk for type 2. And we bring them through a very high-touch program that derives its benefit from social relationships that we form, amongst kind of the participants in the program and a whole orchestration of tools and curricular elements.
So one of the interesting things about this, and thanks for the correction, I meant the DPP, not the DCCT. Here is that there was this, like you were saying, this well-known academically published study that demonstrated that you really could prevent progression to in high-risk individuals, the progression to diabetes. And then what you're trying to do, as I understand it, is take the DPP data and demonstrate how to scale it. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. It's using technology to scale, what has been shown to work very well in a face-to-face setting, using some of the same behavioral science ingredients, because at the end of the day, the reason, if you ask people why they went through DPP, why it worked, in large part, they'll tell you it was because of the social accountability and the peer relationships and, you know, really just getting a lot of TLC. But, you know, our thesis is you can do that digitally.
So software is nice, but people are necessary.
Absolutely. I feel strongly about that.
So we just talked about scale. And I know when you and I talked earlier, one of the things you told me was scale was the definition of why you loved Silicon Valley when you moved there, the sense of scale or ability to scale. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. No, I always stand in awe of the internet. It's completely, you know, I mean, it's completely amazing. You've got, you know, what three billion views for size Gangnam Style. that was one company. That was a company called YouTube that got a fifth of the world's population to watch this video.
I don't know. I think David watched it 35 times himself.
you're half of the 3 million. Yeah, or any time. I mean, you literally scale. The way the software can scale, you almost can't even comprehend it instinctively. You mm-hmm. have to just look at the numbers. It's so hard to even imagine, you know, how many people that is, or imagine how many people search on Google each day. And you see that when you're in the trenches of that, it feels just so intrinsically powerful that you start getting sucked into this concept that, like, oh my gosh, like, I could build something that could reach so many people so quickly that it's hard to do anything else.
I think that's an aspect. I think that's an aspect that comes out a lot that people outside the Valley may not always appreciate, but I know it's a point that Paul Graham of Y Combinator mm-hmm. particularly emphasized, where he actually has an essay that says startup equals growth. And one of the things you're supposed to do when you go to this Y Combinator program, right, is you're supposed to have not year over year, but week over week growth of 10%. I mean, that's sick, right? And it's, but that's sort of more or less like the state. But
it's
kind
of like the growth of somebody with prediabetes, probably. He's probably very familiar with it.
We're trying to cut down that growth.
Exactly. But you've always been kind of a builder type, right? I mean, the building thing for you is very, very intrinsic. I know you told me that you started off with Lego, and now you've scaled to companies. But
so you're one of those kids that played and did all this mini engineering stuff when you were a kid. Did you build things?
Oh, completely. I couldn't stop. I built, obviously tons and tons of Legos.
So you were a maker before it was cool. You were a maker before it was cool.
Yes. Yeah, it definitely was not cool. I think I wore sweatpants through sophomore year of high school.
Was it artisanal Lego? I mean, what was your best Lego creation?
Definitely a space shuttle. I had a really neat space shuttle, and I accessorized it with all of these things that NASA would have been jealous that it had.
That's awesome. And do you have a Lego creation going on in your apartment today?
It has happened. Has the word spread? it was funny. I mean, I do love building things. I love kind of crafting, or just anything that I can build, I have fun with. And I was at a toy store with my girlfriend, and it'd be awesome to build a Lego kit together.
So how did that go over?
A VW bus.
A VW bus.
Pretty recently.
Wow. Was it like the Scooby Doo bus? I mean, did you guys dress up and play it out?
We
should have. And it's a beautiful Lego creation. It's one of my favorites. I can't recommend that kit enough for any listener.
So is it the technology and the pieces, the putting the pieces together that you love about building?
Yeah, tell us which metaphor appeals to you most.
Yeah, or is it the growing? Is it the sense of scaling? What is it about that building experience?
Probably depends on what he's applying to.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Yeah, honestly, it's what I just love. I love just realizing that it's possible to think something up and then make it happen in front of you. It sounds incredibly simple, but Lego is a little bit like that. You're like, wow, this bus could exist. All I need to do is go through all these intricate steps and put in the time and work to get there, and then this thing will exist in the world. And entrepreneurship is not really different. I mean, you're kind of big leagues versus little leagues to some extent, but it's building. It's creating value and figuring out how to reach an end destination with ingredients.
So, do you remember how you first got attracted to entrepreneurship? When did you? How did you first get involved in this gig?
I think it was probably early. It was, it's a little bit hard to pinpoint the exact moment, but it was little things like, you know, I'm mowing the lawn for my family. I'm like, you know, but other families need this to be done. And maybe if I knocked on their door, they would let me do it. And maybe I could exchange that value for money.
The monetization of lawn mowing.
Adventure. It's adventure. That's adventure scum business for sure. So, you know, little things like that, you know, and then thinking creatively how to, you know, build kind of a better mousetrap was always fun for me. You know, I've always been like the sort of person that's, you know, been really upset with the way like little things are designed, like ketchup packets where they're, you know, there's not enough ketchup in it. It like gets all over your hands. It's like, there's just like things where there's clearly got to be a better way. Like I tend to pick up on them in life and really want to try to, you know, make it better.
So when you start off, you know, people talk about how when you're in a company in the very beginning, there's sort of this, you know, you found a company, there's this, all this excitement. And then there's, you know, you get things going and you sort of, wow, and you get more funding and it's really exciting. And then there's sort of like this, what is it, the pit of despair, the plateau of despair? They're sort of like even when it's going well, it gets to be challenging. How have you gotten through some of the more challenging moments startup founders inevitably face? And could you tell us about one of those moments where you've really felt like, wow, this is like, you worried about how things were going to go forward?
Oh, for sure. I mean, there's, you know, any company has plenty of stories, you know, across kind of both of the spectrums. And you know, and it's fascinating. And honestly, what gets you through it is simple determination and grit, because it's such incredibly hard work, very fulfilling work, but you know, it does not come easily.
But is there like an example, like some day where you got some news where you're like, wow, this sucks, and then you sort of, you got to die, like in the unlikely event that ever happened? Like, yeah.
No, I mean, we would have, you know, kind of moments during really, really important times in our business, where, you know, we had a very big potential, you know, channel partner tell us that they decided that instead of bringing us to some of the clients that, you know, we had lined up, they were going to go ahead and compete with us and try to build a competing offering.
Lovely.
You know, and those moments happen, and all of a sudden you're like, wow, you know, you go from, wow, the world's our oyster, this is going to be the, you know, most amazing, you know, next couple of months, to, oh boy, time to put on the jerseys.
Wow.
So constant excitement in both directions.
How did you come back from that? How did you come back from that? Because that, I remember that time in your company, and yep, I remember how devastating that was for you. And, you know, how did you kind of pick yourself up and start back out there?
Great question.
Honestly, it's the same thing. It's grit. Like it's almost hard to describe. It's such a strong desire to make this real that like you almost start to feel like nothing can get in your way. And you'll take so many punches and just get back up and do it. And like that lets you ride through those hard moments where you just know, you know, directionally that this is something that you really want the world to have. And this is just like a little point in time that you got to get through. And you almost accept that these are going to happen, and just don't let it happen. Don't let it get in your way, even though it's like trying to insidiously. And then it's awesome to have camaraderie from teams. I mean, you talk about this a lot, where it's like, if you're doing this with other people around the table, it makes it so much better. Like my, you know, my co-founders and I, we all like get along really well, and we laugh a ton. And I remember even in the darkest moments, like it's kind of funny still. Like some of the, I can't believe this is happening to us moments are riddled with like this funny sense of humor. And you know, that kind of helps as well.
Can you tell us about a specific one? Do you remember a specific moment like that?
Oh man, I mean, the one I just brought up is, you know, there were a lot of laughs that happened, you know, during that, where it's like, it's so bad, it's almost funny. It's like, well, this is going to be so fascinating. So there, you know, that's kind of one. There's, you know, there've been other little ones where, you know, in our early days, we realized after sending out like hundreds and hundreds of scales to people for a research study that we had to update the software. And the only way to do that was to unscrew all the scales and flash it.
Oh my goodness.
Manually. Oh. So we're like, oh my gosh, we have to get we got all the scales back. We spent like a week in an agent's place with this little assembly line where we opened every single scale individually, like soldered, you know, like the, like just like the meat bits on it. It was
like total, Santa's elves.
Total nightmare.
Nice touch, Lisa.
Yeah, it was like Elf, exactly. It was like Elf. And it's not like we didn't have other things happening at that point in time. We had a lot of other stuff to be working on as well. So.
But isn't it funny how even for some technology companies and with, you know, Silicon Valley and all this stuff, there's just still an amazing, at least now we were even talking about this earlier, an amazing amount of elbow grease that's involved in any role, you know?
Yeah. Wow. Never be above making your own copies.
Absolutely.
So, oh, no, for sure, for
or
sure.
Or drawing your own blood, but yeah.
It's very, very hard work.
So when you think about the scale and the software and Silicon Valley and all the you know, the hotness that's out there right now.
Hot.
What's the big successful business out there that just seems crazy to you that, like, you cannot believe people like? Is there one?
In healthcare or any category?
It could be in healthcare or it could be anything
else. You look at something and say, how are these bozos getting any money? Like, boy, there really must be a bubble. What are you?
Well, I think it's interesting because I think there are companies where what's happening is the underpinning. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, who's the nucleus of your world?
You have markets growing so incredibly quickly because of software and software penetration, right? And companies taking advantage of that. I'm sure there are plenty of companies where I'm like, I don't quite know either why they got the funding, et cetera. But I never let myself, I never let my brain try to cast too much judgment because I typically don't have enough visibility into the actual internals of their company to make a judgment. And they may have something in their back pocket that you don't know about. There are companies that, like, I do find, like, that feel like magic.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like, you know, the Lyft and Uber, it's a miraculous experience. Like, because of Lyft hotspots, I commute to work on Lyft, and it's marginally more expensive than a bus ride, and I'm able to do work on Lyft through my hotspot. And that to me, to this day, it feels like absolute magic that I can open up my phone, press a button, and be in a car.
So
I've already entered the destination.
So Lisa, do you see what he did there? How you asked him this question about what was a problem, and he turned it into an opportunity.
That is so entrepreneurial.
It's even with just a year at Harvard, or was it 2 years? You were able to acquire those sort of excellent sort of EQ kind of skills.
Well, if he'd gone all the way through, med school, he would have lost those EQ,
yeah.
EQ skills.
Oh, see that. But tell us. Tell us about that, because you're part of the elite group of people who started and then found something better to do other than finishing, right? So could you tell us about your time in the Fair City in Boston?
Yeah, sure. So it's funny. Remember? So I was really drawn to healthcare meets tech. I applied to MD/MBA programs. I ended up getting accepted into Boston and to Harvard's joint MD/MBA.
By the way, if you're into Harvard, you have to say, I went to Boston, and then they have to ask you, and then you say, oh, Harvard.
Oh, well, sure.
You have to do it as a two-stepper.
I know. It's still instinct to this day.
Snobbery, you know, masked as modesty.
Yeah, the original humble brag. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then you get in there, and it's just normal people that are nice and smart.
Take your word for it. Yeah.
What happened is I took the internship at IDEO along the way after a year, and then just got really passionate about it. I liked my co-founder.
Which year of MD and a year of MBA, or just 1 year of the combined thing?
It's 1 year of the med school. The MBA piece comes a little bit later. So, Omada to...
Wow. You know, to so you're getting a real-world MBA, if you will, even better than consulting, I imagine, huh?
the school of hard knocks.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I mean, with 1 year of med school, I mean, I know you grew up in a somewhat medical household. Your mom was a nurse, I believe, right?
Yep.
Is that...
Yep, that's right, exactly.
Do you feel ever that you... Do you feel like you come from the healthcare world, or do you feel like you come from the tech world? What's your genesis?
Which side are you on?
Well, it's strange.
Who are your people?
Very question. I kind of feel like I come from the tech world, but just want to do. I want to make an impact in healthcare. To be honest, I think I've always, and to that extent, I mean, growing up, my mom was a nurse. I was like such a little engineer at heart. I loved just making things. My dad was an engineer. I liked science. Just liked building. But in terms of like the impact I want to have, like, you know, I want to stay in healthcare forever. I just be on the tech side of it.
Were you always silly, even as a kid? Was your house a silly house, a funny house?
It was, yeah. If my mom didn't grow up in College Springs, if she and my family were in New York, I'm convinced my mom would have been the next Mr. Rogers. she would be world famous. She's just incredibly funny, like things that I thought every mom did. You know, she did, but you know, obviously,
like
she would leave your little bubble. You know, she would. Like, me and her would tag team on this, we'd go around, this is when I was in elementary school, when I was in middle school, we'd go around to elementary schools and do this, like, skit for elementary classrooms on Pioneer Medicine, and, you know, and I'd drop, like, a fake leech into my mouth, my mom would be screaming, like, we'd dress up in Pioneer's costumes and, like, show, like, show painting tools, and literally the only reason my mom did that was because we had some really neat historical medical artifacts from my great-great-grandfather, and she knew a lot about Pioneer Medicine. And there was no purpose. She wasn't getting paid. It was just, like, for fun. And I would ditch middle school to, like, go do this with elementary schools.
That's awesome. I would pay money to see you in a Pioneer outfit, I got to tell you.
I know you would do so.
So what's the big controversy out there in digital health right now that you think, you know, needs to get addressed? What holds back the business?
When is the promise going to be translated, you know?
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, it's interesting. I think the, I wouldn't necessarily call it a controversy, but what I tend to find is that the digital health companies that I'm most excited about tend to be the ones that are just willing to dive into the belly of the beast and almost like suffer through the learning curves, you know, publish studies, you know, go through all the thousands of different security reviews you have to go through when you're contracting with enterprise healthcare customers, almost just, you know, not take shortcuts. I think it's those are the business, I put obviously a mod in that category, where those are the business that excite me the most, because it's a hard road to travel, but you can hit really big impact if you travel it. You know, I think there's no... You know, the healthcare system in the U.S. is exceptionally complicated, and there's no, I don't think there's any shortcuts.
So I remember Esther.
Sometimes I think companies think that there might be, and investors think that there might be, but I don't think there are.
So I remember, like, Esther Dyson called it, what's it, a big calcified hairball, was her description of the healthcare system. And I think it's led a lot in the Valley to sort of want to just disrupt it, to reinvent it, to the idea of, just like you've described, to kind of, you know, that let's try to do it again right kind of thing, or let's just try to, you know, get the, you know, hit the, you know, do it directly with the patient, with the, in a way that sort of gets the messy healthcare system, that the calcified hairball, out of the picture. But you sort of feel like the people who are willing to engage that calcified hairball are still going to wind up doing better because the calcified hairball is going to be around. Is that what you'd say?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard infrastructure to undo. I mean, and there's just so much legacy, and you think of, like, it's such an enormous piece of our economy. And, you know, I mean, you think of the most difficult systems to rework tend to be systems that are primarily people-based, which is, you know, people-based and emotional. And that's everything about healthcare. But, you know, where there's a lot of people, because people-based organizations are very hard to pivot and move. And where there's a high level of emotion and very, very, very low tolerance for risk, which is important that our healthcare system has that, but it's reality, which makes it quite a tricky industry to put in your crosshairs from a disruption standpoint, unless you're willing to dive into the trenches and walk through the maze.
Well, I hate to break it to you, but with all that compassion and empathy, you're sounding a lot more like my view of a physician than a typical technologist. So I don't know if it's a Mark. Yeah, you can take that for what you will.
Well, here's the great thing. The great thing about building an enterprise healthcare business is once you know, there's a bit of a. It takes a little bit longer to turn the engine on. It takes a little bit more money to turn the engine on. But once the engine's on, I mean, you can, you know, the impact you can have is just unbelievable. I mean, you can open up enormous populations. You know, it's really neat the impact you can have, but you know, you have to dive into the, you know, the effervescent hairball to make it happen.
So it sounds like if you've got an engine like that, all you need is the hot spot and off you go.
There you go.
Well, thanks a lot, Sean. We're out of time, but so appreciate having you on the show today.
Fantastic.
Of course.
Great talking to you.
Yeah, no, an honor to be on, and thank you so much, Lisa and David.
Take care.
Pleasure.